He's not here.
Okay, and
Did she say we're recording?
Yes. So Lisa's not here. Spring break.
Oh, that's right.
Whatever.
So it's just us, so we all have to agree tonight.
Uh-oh.
It's gonna be hard. It's really gonna be hard.
Still a free country.
I'd like to welcome everyone to the North Salt Lake City Council Work Session of April 4th, 2023. And our first item is, once Heidi takes a big bite, we'll turn it over to Heidi.
I can actually see this better. This is great. Thank you, Mayor. In the package, there should have been a financial report for the end of February. It should have included the full detailed report as well as a financial summary, and then some additional tables related to wages and benefits and how they impact the rest of the overall citywide budget, as was discussed at the last city council meeting. So I wanted to go over to those tables in a little bit more detail. So it went to, there we go. So this table breaks out citywide expenditures into four categories: personnel, operating, capital, and transfers. And if you take a look at these numbers, note that fiscal year 2023 are early projections of where we think we're going to end the year. We'll look at during the budget retreat some more updated numbers as well as what those impacts will be on the fund balance. But looking at these early projections, it looks as if personnel is 38% of the total budget, operating is 23%, capital is 23%, and transfers is 14.6%. If you go to the previous 2 years, I don't have these statistics up on the screen, but for 2021, personnel was actually 33% of the total budget, and in fiscal year 2022, actual numbers, it was 26%. So you can see there's been a range over the last 5 years of anywhere between that 26 and 33% actual, because it's so dependent on spending in the other areas as far as capital goes and what's been programmed in those areas. So it's a little bit different than the fire district, in that their capital expenditures, since they don't have infrastructure, tend to be pretty static year over year. So we will see some swings like that, but overall about 26 to 33% of total budget. This next slide represents the growth in citywide wages. And note these numbers include wages and benefits as well over the last 5 years. I've put on the screen, this wasn't in the packet, I didn't have it available at the time, but the COLA history to provide some background, as well as the new FTEs that were approved in the budget year. So if you take the average of growth from 2019 to where we're projected to end 2023, which is a big year, we did a big COLA in 2023 plus added four new positions, we're averaging about 8% per year in wage and benefit growth. And that is everything from merit increases, benefits increases. And as a side note, medical does tend to go up about 8% per year. That's the growth rate that's been pretty standard, as well as the addition of those new positions. Most of these positions have been, as you'd suspect, in public safety and public works. Quickly going over the COLA history, in 2019, there was a 3% COLA. In 2020, there was no COLA. In 2021, there was a delayed COLA. I think this was when we were all trying to determine the impacts of COVID. Many entities, public entities, did this, but then we ended up doing a mid-year COLA of 2%. In 2022, there was a 1.5% COLA for all city staff at the beginning of the year with an adjustment for public safety wages that ended up being close to 23%, but dependent on the position. And then in 2023, a 7% COLA. And so just wanted to present some background information in preparation for our budget retreat. It's always good to know where you've been to make decisions about where you're going. So, were there any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Heidi. Can I just ask maybe a general question to you, Ken? How is our workforce, labor force stabilized, do you think? I mean, we did some large increases hoping to hang on to people. And
That's a really good question. It's one we talk about a lot. I may have Craig answer for his department. I think in other departments, from time to time, we lose people to agencies that are willing to pay a little bit more, or perhaps people move to be promoted. I think overall, as it relates to your question, Mayor, I would say that our wages are competitive, and in particular, in the last 18 months to 2 years, we've been checking in with the market. We paid a service to evaluate our salaries and wages, and that was helpful to us. I think in public safety, both in the fire, I'll just speak to the fire district because that's, I know more about that maybe from my service there, but they're losing people to other fire agencies. I think hiring is aggressive in the fire service and the public safety medical service. It's pretty aggressive with large agencies to the south of us. And so that fire district's losing people at a pretty alarming rate. So Craig, if you have any thoughts on police.
Just from the police department standpoint, North Salt Lake was very early to recognize the need to be very competitive in our wages, especially with the Salt Lake County wages. So because of that, we have not really lost people. We have had a couple that have not passed through our training program that we've had to let go. And it takes close to a year. So we are just in the next few months going to be, I'm hoping that we won't lose any more due to training issues. But we're anticipating we're going to be a full operational staff for the first time in a long time, probably by August. We have one officer right now who is in the field training program who just graduated from the police academy. We have two more that will be graduating this month after their academy service and training, and then they'll all be in field training from anywhere from, you know, 4 to 5 months. So we've been stable. We have not lost any of our longtime employees for any reason other than failure to perform, and we've had to dismiss them because of wages or anything like that.
Thank you. Our next item, we're going to outlaw flooding in our city. Karen?
Done. So there's been some concern in the city and obviously statewide in what the snowpack means. And the question came to staff about what we're doing and how we're preparing. And so in general, you know, we have this historic snowpack level. But the question is, what does that mean for our city? And what flood risk do we have to properties that the city owns? And what risks are there to the residents of and their private properties? So our snowpack is at least the highest it's been in 70 years, possibly ever. So we have potential runoff conditions, drainage from the foothills. So obviously the snowpack's up in the mountains. How does that come to us? How does that affect us? And what will it look like for us? So we need to do a risk assessment. The greatest risk is always with drainage channels. So we're looking at direct channel impacts, stormwater facilities, and possible flooding locations. So this is a topographic map or a map of the area directly above the city. This is zoomed out a bit. To the north is Bountiful, to the south is Salt Lake City. But I think what's important about this is you can see the blue lines that mark those stream channels. So the foothills directly above North Salt Lake channel into City Creek to the south that enters Salt Lake City, and channels into Mill Creek to the north that enters into Bountiful, plus a smaller creek. So these locations are the ones that see the highest level of runoff. So the high levels of snowpack in the mountains drain down through these watershed areas and hit these creek locations and then are diverted north and south, but not directly into North Salt Lake. So this is a zoomed-in topographic area directly above North Salt Lake City. You can orient there on Eaglewood Loop around the golf course. You can see that there are a number of small ravines that are located directly above us. So these create very small watershed areas. They're so small that there aren't streams or creeks located in them, but any snowfall that falls directly within these basins will drain into North Salt Lake. So this is that same location, and the blue lines are not creeks, but those are those bottom of those ravines where that water will funnel when that snow melts. And you can see there are four points that this water enters our city. So one is at Wild Rose Trail, one is at the top of Woodbriar Way, one comes down through the new Eaglewood Cove 13 development, where it has always abutted into Eaglewood Loop, and the last is there at the north, where it hits Cove Circle that's up Alcala Road. The benefit of knowing where these are is it allows us to know where to watch, where the risks are happening, and with these areas very well delineated, it gives us a very good idea of how much water we might see. So this is the same kind of general area, but it makes it very clear what those mountain peaks look like. So those small valleys or ravines do not have stream channels in them. We have minimum canyon outlets. There's only four. And they're all very small drainage basins. So the benefit of having all this information is that we know where those discharge points are or may be. So the risk assessment associated with this, again, channel flow is the greatest typical source of flooding. You see people preparing for events on the news or on the TV, and they talk about City Creek, and they talk about all of these channels. What happens are those rivers swell or those streams enlarge. The banks aren't capable of carrying the flow, and that's where a flooding event occurs, are along those open channels. We don't have any major drainage channels or streams. So our biggest flood hazard from high volume is significantly less than the neighboring communities both north and south of us. The biggest hazards that occur as far as health and safety and property damage are rarely the water. It's usually debris flow or mudslides. And again, those are characteristics of these stream channels that are not as impactful to us. So we're looking at all the risks that we need to monitor or prepare for. We have obviously rapid snowmelt, saturated soil conditions, and potential flood events. So rapid snowmelt is actually the risk versus the amount of snowmelt. How quickly the snow melts creates, that's the largest factor that creates an impact on the city. So gradual warming provides controlled conditions. The snow melts, it goes away, nobody worries. If we have very rapid melting, that's when you have a flooding potential from a very large amount of water trying to drain through an area that just isn't built for it. Rain events, while the snow is melting, significantly increase the risk. And that's kind of what happened in 1983. So there is obviously existing snowpack in the watershed area above North Salt Lake, but it is not extreme. So when you hear about this massive snowpack of 700 or 800 inches and they're getting 2 feet a day, that is not in the foothill area that drains into us. Up at Cottonwood Canyon, up at the ski resorts, in many of those really high elevations, that hits the watershed basins that feed into streams and rivers. That is not going to affect us directly. So prior to this recent storm system, much of the snow in those elevations had already melted. Just as it does every year, it melts and nobody notices. It snowed again, so we will again have this snowstorm melt, but we don't have those really extreme snowpack locations. So as far as the rapid level of snow melting, what we've done is look at the weather forecast. So this is based on the information provided from the National Weather Service. Looking at April, May, and June, the current long-range forecast is below normal or normal temperatures, which gives us a low risk for that rapid snowmelt. So this kind of weather pattern is very similar to what we saw in 2011. There's some snow. So in 2011, they were predicting that we would have similar events to what we had in 1983, and they never materialized. The difference was 1983, everything warmed up very, very quickly and rained. And in 2011, we had this more normalized weather pattern of cool temperatures and the snow melted gradually. We'll continue to watch the weather. As we all know, weather forecasts are not entirely correct all of the time. So saturated soil conditions is the next factor that we're concerned about. Slope stability, of course, is what we're looking at. The factors that affect slope stability are heavy rainfalls, freeze-thaw action, and snowmelt water infiltration. And these are specific to places with seasonal freezing, just like North Salt Lake. So the conditions we see from snowmelt are very similar to saturated soil we see from rain. And studies for snowmelt-induced landslides or other catastrophic events are actually quite rare. Most of the studies are involved in rainfall events, but the process is very similar. The most important factor is how quickly the water is introduced. So again, massive rainstorm creates more hazards than gentle rain. Very rapid snowmelt creates more hazards than a gradual snowmelt. So the risks that we're concerned potentially may happen would be slope failures, both natural and constructed, erosion of slopes, increased surface runoff, and retaining wall failures. We have a number of natural ravines in North Salt Lake that are in residential areas. They're part of our storm drain system, as well as countless retaining walls all over the mountainside. So the kind of things we want to watch for are failure points that are occurring, cracks and slopes, etc. We're not expecting any of these events to occur, but there are things that we're watching for. And then, of course, the last situation would be flood events. So the types of flood events we are most likely to see in North Salt Lake, or greatest risk for, would be floods caused by elevation and grade, and floods caused by failure of existing structures or infrastructure. So we're looking for what locations do we have potential flooding that we need to be prepared for. So this is the FEMA map, the flood insurance rate map. And this is the old style. It's the older version. These were the paper maps. What I wanted to show you is the historical location of the floodplain. This is west of Legacy. You can kind of see on the right the streets and locations. That's Foxboro. So we do not have a floodplain location in our residential areas. These are the new FEMA maps. So they have changed to a GIS layer, this national flood mapping system. We do have a couple of flood zones, everything that's kind of that blue color. We have both Zone A and Zone AE. The only difference are both 1% annual chance of flooding. The only difference between the two is in Zone AE, we have a base flood elevation that's been provided. So, for example, the larger area on this map has a base flood elevation of 4218. Zone A does not have a base flood elevation given because no detailed studies have been done in those areas. Excuse me. If you look towards the center of the city, there is an area, it looks like a snake, that runs through the industrial zone. That is directly around existing and previous storm drain channels. So again, it's the open channel flow that gives us the greatest risk. Some of those areas have been piped, some of them still exist, but they create floodplains because in massive rain events, you get flooding out over the banks. We do have some concern regarding potential flood events in the area around the Jordan River and the West Side development. We are not concerned that the Jordan River is going to overflow. They have a number of controls on there. There are a lot of plans in place to move as much water as possible during spring runoff to the Great Salt Lake. What we are concerned about, however, is there are two commercial developments in this area. One is the Riverbend development that's north of that 215 route you can see, and then the outlet, Recreation Outlet subdivision that's to the south. That's where the trailer park is, the RV park, and some businesses. Both of these areas, their storm drain outlet is tied directly into the Jordan River. We have flap gates so that the water can't come back. But if the level in that river is allowed to rise very high, which are controlled by others, then the storm drain facilities in these subdivisions will not drain. The water won't come back on us, but our water won't be able to get out. So this is an area that we're going to be keeping an eye on. So the next kind of flood events that we're concerned about would be failure of existing controls. So our existing storm drain system is designed, detention retention ponds are designed for a 100-year storm event. And all of the individual lot locations for businesses and other development are based on a 10-year storm. So maintenance monitoring is extremely important for us to keep everything functioning properly. And then, of course, the improved mapping and location, our knowledge of where our pipes are and what's happening is a huge benefit in allowing us to have increased response time or a faster response time. So we've had a couple flood events in the past that came from failure of existing control. So this is our first example. This is the Nathan Clark Basin. This is located along Coventry and Maria Lana. So this is the location of the storm drain outlet. It comes down the ravine that parallels Coventry. The water goes into the storm drain outlet, flows through pipes down into the ravine below. There was debris that clogged the outlet structure in this detention basin, and it overspilled. It went down the little road there directly adjacent to it and washed out this area. It's important to note that this is a ravine. There wasn't risk to the homes around it. You know, this is very, very deep in the hole compared to what's around it. But we lost 100 feet or more of curb and gutter and sidewalk during this event because that debris had scoured out of the ravine and clogged the outlet. This is a picture of what that ravine looks like. You can see the storm water flowing down the middle and the branches and overgrowth. So this is kind of the location that we're worried about with these natural channels. Although they aren't natural streams, these natural ravines are used for storm drain channels. Another event that's happened in the past, we had some issues with the UDOT detention basins. So this is Center Street and Foxborough Drive, right before you go up and over Legacy. So when they built this area and rerouted Center Street, this is their detention basin location. So what happens is the water from all of these areas locates in here and then it drains away on a controlled basis. Well, we had flooding happening in the upper right-hand corner, the upper basin, and all of the information we had implied that that drained into the basin in the lower left-hand corner of that box. And so we were pumping water from one to the other, assuming the pipe was blocked and couldn't figure out why the water would never go down. Well, the very bottom right-hand corner of that yellow box is a Dominion Energy facility. It's a fence with gravel and some pipes up out of the ground. But in some of their work, coming in and out, turns out the drainage pipe's actually right there. And they had removed that drainage channel or blocked it, and so nothing from these detention basins was able to drain. So this is kind of an example of why it's really important for us to have identified where our piping is and know where it goes. Once we found the problem, the correction was very simple. So our existing storm drain system, as I've alluded to, is very well defined at this point and very well mapped. In 2022, we had a master storm drain study done by Bowen Collins. They looked at all of the existing facilities and whether or not they were properly sized, recommended some improvements, worked on our CFP. And this is kind of the overall system map that came from this. One thing I think it's very important to note, if you see the little yellow boxes scattered around, those are detention basins. For example, Hatch Park, Deer Hollow Park are both dual-purpose locations. In a major storm event, or if we were to get a very large amount of runoff water, whether from snowmelt or from rain on top of snowmelt, those facilities will flood, and they're supposed to. That is not a failure of our infrastructure. The intent is that the water is held and then released slowly so it doesn't overwhelm. And by dual-purposing those locations, we have a place to play baseball, as well as to hold our stormwater. So kind of the overall analysis of the snowmelt impacts of North Salt Lake, kind of a recap. Snowmelt has the greatest impact on streams and channels that we don't really have. So weather is the greatest single factor in how quickly it melts. If we have a nice controlled warm up over a long period of time, we're not really going to see much effect from this. And we have the recent stormwater study, we have a hydrologic model, we have improved mapping, we have data storage, all of which will significantly reduce our risk and allow our city staff and public works to deploy very quickly to fix any problems. The point we want to make is that all the factors indicate that this really historic year of snow will not significantly impact North Salt Lake. However, our preparation is for the very worst case scenario. Okay, but what if? So the snowmelt flooding in North Salt Lake, again, we have these defined watershed areas, we know where it's coming in, and then make sure our stormwater facilities and our public works department are prepared. And that is gonna come from John.
All right, thank you. So I'm just gonna go over a couple of our stuff that we've, things that we prepared for. So this is just a look in some of those detention basins. This is a Gregerson detention basin that's up off of Center Street, just above here. And then Deer Hollow Reservoir. I just took these pictures the other day. Deer Hollow Reservoir we actually have on camera, so that's our tower shot right there, so we monitor that all the time. Some things we found, these are some little basins that we have along Valley View Drive. Looked like we had some downed tree branches from the snow, possibly. So we just need to get in there and clean these out so they don't float down and block the outlets and cause these basins to overflow. This is really minor stuff, and as Karen alluded to, that snow melt's not gonna be an issue here. This would be for like more rain events that would cause a problem. Again, with the Nathan Clark Basin in that same area, that Karen showed you, we have this canyon natural drainage channel that we just need to go through and take some chainsaws and just cut back so that we don't get any of that debris floating down into the basin. And it's significant to note that when we did have that flooding event there, we've done some improvements to that basin since. It was like an earthen basin back when it overflowed. And we've now like concreted in, so it's easier to clean out the debris that comes down in there. And we've increased the amount of channels that basin can drain into the storm drain, so it doesn't fill full of so much water. Other things we've done to prepare, we've got like the other day we filled 4 pallets of sandbags, so we have those ready to go that we can throw on a truck and get out immediately if we need to, plus we have 5,000 plus empty sandbags sitting on the shelf. We made a sandbag, self-serve sandbag pile down at Public Works. I've had a few people come down and take advantage of that so far. We advertised that. And we're ready to deploy those throughout the city in other places if we need to. Our fleet department went through all of our small pumps to make sure that they were all working. And so we have those on hand ready to go. So our biggest part is just keeping up with our standard operating procedures with stormwater. That's the street sweeping, the inlet cleaning, and our basin inspections. So we are inspecting those quite regularly, and keeping records of what we find. They found just the other day up at Deer Hollow, some rocks had gotten into the slots and it had started backing up. So they got those rocks removed. So that basin started working like it was supposed to. And then posting this stuff on social media to have people keep an eye out for the storm drain. Our guys are also walking around or driving around looking at these storm drain inlets for leaves and debris that are blocking and cleaning those off. So just to have people aware, maybe they can give us a hand, and if they see that in front of their house, they could just clean it off real quick or give us a call. So that's the kind of stuff that we're doing. And I think with the street sweeping, since the snow came so early, we weren't able to get as much sweeping done in the fall up on the hillside. So there were still some areas with lots of leaves in it. So we're trying to get to those as they've melted out. But obviously we're not doing that today. So,
John, could you go back to that previous slide?
Sure.
You might want to tell the council on the right, we have some forms there that you might want to explain briefly how we use elements to document what we're doing.
Oh, sure. So this is our work order program. So the when the stormwater guys are water guys, they use the same program too, but they'll go in and they'll fill out detailed information of stuff that they found. It timestamps everything. They attach pictures of before and after. So it's been a great tool. They also track their labor on there, so we know how much time we're spending in these basins and cleaning things out. A lot of the stuff that's been recently has been very minimal time spent, because we've been trying to keep up on things, so we don't have to spend a lot of time cleaning these basins out.
I just had one question, John. So we've received notification from Weber Water, or the South Davis Water District, that they'll charge the system on April 17th. And so normally I think we'd want to fill up Deer Hollow, so we're ready to start irrigating and stuff, but I would assume we're going to try to keep that as empty as possible during the runoff stage. So,
well, Deer Hollow has capacity built into it for the reservoir and also for detention for the storm event. If we could go back to the picture way at the beginning, you can see the this one. If you look inside, you can see that bathtub ring. That's the reservoir part, and then all that above the bathtub ring is for stormwater storage. So it's been built to handle the flow of both. So we will probably be filling that reservoir
anyway.
So
okay. Well, we've got Lisa to keep an eye on it.
We'll close the valve and it will fill itself up. So.
In that frame of mind,
when it does fill up, which it will probably, where the baseball or the swing sets are and whatnot, maybe we should put up police tape or something that people don't go over there and get in. I doubt they will, but little kids have no idea how cold that water is.
Yeah, we've seen people go in there and swim before.
Yeah, it's fun. It's different in the summer, but it could be deadly here this year if it's super cold.
Yeah.
So maybe if we could just make sure that's blocked off.
I just had a couple of questions. One I sent to Lisa, maybe you didn't get it.
I did. Talk about it.
Oh, okay. Tunnel Springs. That used to have a lot higher flow, and I imagine the water coming into Tunnel Springs itself comes from way up in the mountains. And I was just curious, and I know that Lisa's husband had known a lot about it, so just curious to see if that's going to be an issue. Back in 83, there wasn't any homes up there and really nothing around, so it really didn't matter, but I'm just wondering how much of the water, I think I remember Paul telling us the pipe will handle like 125 cubic feet per minute or something like that.
It's been really low. I think the last time we really looked at it was like less than 25 gallons a minute that we
right,
were getting
right.
out of
that. Because of the drought and stuff, it's been really low. But I'm just wondering if we're anticipating that flow to get high enough that the overflow, of course, it'll has quite a better room there. But we also know the water table up there isn't very far down from the ground either. So
yes, so the tunnel springs, the springs themselves are fed from fractured bedrock that's directly above it, which is functions differently than like an alluvial fan.
Okay.
So one's like a sponge. All of the water kind of goes down and fills an entire area. And the fractured bedrock it's fractures in the rock. Whatever water gets directly into that location. So one of the things that we can do is monitor what kind of flows are coming out. We have a couple of options, including right now it's all diverted into the wetlands. If it appears to be a problem, we can divert it further down and pump it over to the lake and the golf course or use some of the golf course area to disperse that water. I've been doing a lot of asking questions on are there any areas that has anybody ever seen a problem at this location? Tunnel Springs was one of those. And none of staff have ever seen that water flow heavily during a spring runoff that would create a flooding event. And again, the area directly above us is going through this melt snow cycle. So we are unlikely to see significantly more water this year than we saw other years because that snowpack keeps reducing every time it warms up. It will be higher, but not 100 times higher or 10 times higher. Okay. So that's one of the places we'll add to our watch list.
Okay. The other thing I was wondering is, you know, I've got some great pictures of the Hatch Park detention basin doing exactly what it's supposed to do, and also up there at Deer Hollow Park. But I do remember years ago when we did have a lot of water come down, and the water we had, they had a channel, and I guess you'd call it like a dam would have a overflow channel that put it out on the street, and I don't think that's there anymore. So I'm just curious as what would happen in the event that we did, pipes got plugged or we didn't have any place to put the water, where would it go, and is that designed into that?
Sure. So when we rebuilt all of the detention basins that are occurring, so there's three at Deer Hollow Park, the upper basin, and then the medium and the lower, and when we rebuilt it, that overflow structure that's in place, that middle section typically doesn't flood. You know, we have pictures of when it has. But what would end up happening if the entire structure were to overflow, if everything, it gets diverted out into the street. Okay. There's some channels there's a channel that built there.
Yeah. I was going to go up and look at it, but I didn't get a chance. Yeah. But I do remember being up there really late one night with sandbags and worrying about the whole thing breaking loose and flooding the apartment at the bottom and those kind of things.
And that was probably before we built the concrete one.
Yes, it was.
So very different kinds of volume storage. As John was saying, Deer Hollow currently is sized to hold 1 million gallons of secondary water. And when it's completely full, it will still hold all of the rain event from a 100-year storm above us.
Okay.
So by having it partially full or collecting that water for later use, we also have it on telemetry. So if we have major amounts of water and we want to retain it at that location so it doesn't go further down, we can then open up valves, close valves, and release some of that water for additional capacity the next week or the next day.
Or pump it up the hill.
It up the hill. We can turn the pumps on and take it back up to the lake.
Sure. One other question I had in the Foxborough area. We know that some of the area out there is very flat, and when it was all designed. And, of course, that's supposed to flow west, and if there's not a very, very big area for it to flow into because the water levels come up, what's the concerns there? And I also know that there's some yards and places down there that had a really tough time draining over the years. So
I'm going to show them the map.
So individual yards and the way that they grade are obviously kind of an individual location. But overall, I don't know if you can see the area very well through here, but right along Legacy is a very large drainage channel. And I can't see very well from here, but right through Foxborough along 1100 North, we have a very, very large channel.
Right.
The low flow channel in there is lined with concrete, and that's typically the only water we ever see in there. The reason that channel is so large and has such a capacity for water is exactly what you're talking about. The amount of water you can move through any pipe or channel is 100% dependent on the slope. And things are very, very flat out here, and so the water moves slowly, and so it tends to rise. So that storage capacity, again, was built for a 100-year storm. I think the overall level of reassurance I'd like to give you is that there is, in Foxborough today, there's 10 inches of snow. Maybe 12. I don't know, Natalie, but, you know, I mean, it's
not as much.
Right. So you get up in the foothills and they may have 2 feet of snow. So a 2-foot level of snow is well within our capacity to store in all of our detention and retention basins. So while there is a risk potential for things happening in Foxborough or other flat areas, the good news is, I'm going to go back here. The good news is all of Foxborough is out of what FEMA considers to be a floodplain area. There's not a single spot in there. And if you look through the commercial or in the industrial area in the middle, those channels are considered flood hazards. Those are very small storm drain channels. Not a single one of our channels in Foxborough has been identified by FEMA as being a flood hazard. So we're fairly confident that the design will hold, even if we end up with significant amounts of spring runoff to a size we've never seen since Foxborough was built. I've never seen that channel full. If it fills up, I'll go take a picture, because it'll be once in a lifetime.
And didn't we install pumps in that channel a little bit so that it can keep the water moving? There's something that's there that looks like a hose or something.
Yeah.
Low flow.
That's the one on 1100 North?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's we've put a pump in there just because it's so flat to help
so
keep that money.
So if we needed to. Okay, thanks, John.
One other question. I know I'm asking a lot, but and I'm pretty confident that we did it right, but we know that Hatch Park's a retention basin. If it ever did fill up, would it overflow onto Center Street or overflow into the backyards of, I guess, what the city now owns as property?
Right. So Hatch Park actually has an outflow.
I'm just wondering if it, right. The outflow was plugged or didn't take enough water, where sure. would it actually emergency
so
bypass?
What, right. So interestingly enough, the largest problem we have with Hatch Park, and it's not really a problem, but one of the things that's on our list of repairs or changes we want to make is that Hatch Park doesn't control the flow out enough. We'd like to detain the water more than we currently are. So it's one of those locations where we have a known point of discharge. If that is filling rapidly, then Public Works will go and verify, make sure that there's nothing clogging it. While it's not convenient to do, it's fairly easily cleaned. So if it were to ever overtop and go somewhere, off the top of my head, I'd have to go look at our topo maps. But I'd be happy to do that and let you know what
well,
I find.
Well, I assume it was designed to go on a Center Street, but then there's no
yes.
structure to take it, so it'd become like a dam breaking.
Sure, and I actually also assume it's designed to go on a Center Street. So usually an overflow point is part of that outlet structure, which is there directly adjacent to the road. What ends up happening in most locations are, as I was telling you, most facilities for individual locations are designed for a 10-year storm. They will fill up parking lots and spill out into streets. Our streets are designed to take the 100-year storm overflow. So water running down, filling up to curb to top back of curb elevation or running down the streets is actually part of our storm drain facility system. You're all looking at me like I'm crazy. It's a real thing.
No, I know. I've seen it work on Center Street before, so I know.
Yeah.
I just want to point out that in my limited time, we've had 300-year storms.
Yeah,
100-year storms kind of a little misleading, isn't it?
It is. 300 years now we've had.
3 2 years.
One other question, and this might be a long-term thing. We've talked about the pump, Honeywell pump recently, and how the ground settled. Mm-hmm. Is the ground going to start coming back up?
So that's one of the things we talked about. If the groundwater table rises again, so despite the historic levels of moisture and snow that we've had, this 1 year doesn't end the drought. So that groundwater table will not rise to its previous condition from even 2 or 3 years consecutively like this. So when we spoke about that subsidence and whether or not we thought it would go up, there's a technical advisory group that I'm part of all the cities in South Davis County and consultants for the water districts. And we talked about the type of soil that they found through their investigational bores. And what I'm told by the geotech specialist is that if it rehydrates, it doesn't expand. It's not the kind of soil that when dry is shortens and then when it gets wet, it expands again.
Okay.
It's non-expansive. Once that settlement occurs, it's permanent.
Okay. That's what I was curious about.
But if we can get the water table up and the settlement stops, that would be fantastic.
All right. I think that's all my questions.
I have just one or two. The last week or two, we had a fire hydrant that was struck, and so water was streaming down Eaglewood Drive. And we were able to help. And there were some photos that we found where the water is piping, where the seam is, there's a crack. I've got video footage of it, and you can see it popping up, which makes me worry that under the street, we're having it hollowing out.
Hmm.
And my understanding is that's what happened here next to Center Street, next to the City Hall. But it was not a big event, really, right? I mean, it was a short-lived, maybe 2 hours. I don't know how long that water was flowing. But it was enough to create that piping. So I'll show you the video, and that's something I'd like us to pay attention to, because I'm worried that in that area where we've got the soil underneath collapsing, and then now we've got piping, and
yeah,
we're going to have a road collapse.
So that location would be really helpful to us to know where that was coming up.
Okay.
So the good news is when a water lane breaks and washes down underneath the road, the voids are created when the fines wash out somewhere. So if we have water coming up through the street, it's not taking a lot of material with it. When the waterline crew removes the dirt, they look for those. But that's the kind of thing we would want to go out and do some investigation on and make sure that we don't end up with a void under the road further down that we didn't know about.
Yeah. Well, this water coming up was bringing up dirt.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. And we've got that. And then the other thing is, I know you're not a horticulturalist, but is the water situation going to be too much saturation for us to be planting trees in the end of April?
No, so it's been a very wet winter. It's entirely possible that Arbor Day will not be a great day, but that, unfortunately, is a question maybe for TJ. Maybe John knows.
I guess we'll see when we start digging the holes what they look like.
We won't know really until we dig.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Any other questions?
I guess I just had one more. I just remember all the discussion we had during the landslides and even some of the backyards where they says we don't want sprinklers in the backyard because if the ground gets oversaturated, the wall's going to fail. And are we concerned about some of those backyards now where they're going to have a lot of snow that's melting and saturating the ground?
Yeah, so that's one of the things that we're watching for most carefully. So the landslide area itself, there are drains that have been installed to help do that. But we've got retaining walls and slopes all over the city that may or may not be affected by the saturated conditions. We've had multiple 100-year storms in the last few years. The soil can only get as wet as it can get, right? So the idea that we're watching for are all of the kind of telltale signs, really major storm events that typically happen in July or August are our greatest risk in all locations. About, I don't know, 12, 15 years ago, we had a major storm event on Father's Day. And I probably had a list of 30 places that had called in saying we have a problem. And Paul and I went out and looked at all of these locations. We split the list in half and ran all over town and, you know, small failures and rivers running behind retaining walls. And that's the kind of thing that could occur with really heavy snowmelt because it would have as much water as those really intense storm events if it heated up from today to 80 in a couple of days. We don't see that happening. So what we'll do is the same kind of work on a more intense level to look for problems. I don't see issues with the Pace Lane landslide happening. But, of course, that area and others will be ones that we watch very carefully.
And the Spring Hill landslide that we did all the work on and stuff, and, of course, we were told then that every year that we got a heavy snow, it would move.
Yeah.
And, of course, those heavy snows weren't like the heavy snow we got this year. So.
Right.
But I don't know where it's going to move to now since most of the houses are gone where it was causing the problem. At least we assume that's the case.
Yeah, so it doesn't move to, it just kind of moves in this humpy slump.
Yeah, it's not.
That's the technical term.
Not going to go on the road at this point, but it might rise above the sidewalk.
Right, it might move a bit. Again, what's happened, I just live in Bountiful, and I live at about the same elevation as the Eagle Golf Course. And my yard had very small amounts of snow left on Saturday. And now, of course, I have probably a foot and a half, 2 feet again. But that melt and thaw cycle that we're having is actually really to our benefit because the is running off every time it melts instead of accumulating.
Okay, thank you.
So do you mind if I just add, council member, I think in part of your question relates to sprinklers, if I understood. And I think I would tell the council that we're working on some outreach for the spring to educate residents and help residents understand that they probably won't need to water their yards and their lawns for a long time. We've also had some wall failures, and we've had some individual homeowners digging into slopes when they shouldn't have. So we're also working on an education piece that we will actually send to people out in the foothills that will tell them what they should and should not do with respect to slopes and retaining walls and watering practices and all those things that could keep them safe. Because I think in your question is really is an important practice that residents need to be more aware of when they have retaining walls. And they can really damage their own property if they're overwatering or if they design their sprinkler systems in a way that continues to saturate rock walls and because water will do a lot of damage in those situations. So we're working on some outreach in the foothills, and you'll see that in the next 90 days or so.
I just remember the one property up there, the wall did fail, and it came down way down the hill and affected the people there, and we ended up in a lot of closed sessions.
Yeah, we've had a number of cases.
Just that was a broken sprinkler line, wasn't it?
I think so, and it saturated the ground, and the water and the retaining wall failed. And
it was, but it was also an owner that was unwilling to remove the sprinkler system out of their backyard. We had ordered that. And fortunately, that's all been resolved, and they don't have a sprinkler system in their backyard now. So
they just have a lot of snow.
Just
kidding.
Thank you, Karen and John. That was interesting. Let's take a quick break, and we'll reconvene in 3.5 minutes.